I'm Jim Wallace of Sojourners, and you're listening to Jim Wallace in Conversation, a place where we talk about the hunger for justice and the search for spirituality. Today, we're going to talk about a man who I think is changing hearts and minds more than anyone on the planet, even changing the oldest, biggest church in the world, which many people thought was impossible. I'm talking, of course, about Pope Francis. Maybe you remember that picture from the day after he was elected Pope, when he took the bus back to his hotel to pay for his bill in person. That humility, that desire to be with the people, to be ordinary, has marked his years in office since. So today I'm very excited to welcome author and activist Mark Shriver. His new book, Pilgrimage, traces the life of Pope Francis from his childhood in Argentina all the way to the Vatican. It's a real treat to have you here with us, Mark, a real treat.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
I should note that you're not just an author. You're the president of Save the Children Action Network, which is influencing policy and kids worldwide. And you're a former lawmaker in the Maryland House of Delegates. We'll get back to some of that later, but first, what made you want to do this book and spend so much time with Pope Francis?
On a couple of different levels. I mean, when he got on that balcony at St. Peter's and asked the folks to bless him before he blessed them, that was kind of stunning. I was educated by the Jesuits in high school and in college up at Holy Cross College up in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is the best school in America, I think. And those Jesuit teachers and that culture of challenging you intellectually and spiritually and pushing you, in my case, pushing me, fascinated me. And here was the first man to become Pope who was a Jesuit. And then a couple of weeks later, when he got on his knees, a 75, 76-year-old man got on his knees and washed the feet of juvenile delinquents. And I had worked with juvenile delinquents in Baltimore City for 6 years, and I've been in those juvenile facilities. I wouldn't get on my knees today and wash and kiss the feet of those kids. Those are tough situations. Mm-hmm. And here's a 76-year-old man on Holy Thursday kissing the feet of a girl, a Muslim, mm-hmm. a young lady who's a girl who'd broken the law. I mean, I've been around, you know, Holy Thursday celebrations my whole life. And here's this Pope on his knees. Wow. And his first trip a couple of weeks later is to Lampedusa to be with migrants, people who are dying, trying to go across the Mediterranean. So there were all these questions, and then I learned that he had this incredible rise to power as a young 36-year-old man, and then had a fall, exiled into Cordoba, and then another rise, a different rise. I wanted to dig in and try to figure out who he was. Were these gestures just gestures to garner goodwill for the Catholic Church, or was this guy the real deal?
That's a great arc of the whole book. You just laid it out beautifully there. And I read this book word for word.
Yes.
And it's, you know those kids whose feet he kissed. You know those situations in your own work.
Yes.
And you know what it would mean for a pope, not just a man or a priest, but a pope to be there and do that. I love what you said when you said you were yearning for a church you could believe in.
You know, those things about Francis on the scene, and obviously, you know, in my own mind, you had the banking scandals going on under Pope Benedict. You had the sexual abuse scandals here in America and across the world. And, you know, worrying about whether Pope Benedict was wearing red shoes and those other issues didn't resonate with the Catholic Church that I knew, the great nuns and priests that I've seen working all across America and around the world doing great work. So there was a disconnect. And this guy was doing things, Pope Francis was doing things right out of the chute, so to speak, paying his own hotel room bill that resonated with priests and nuns that I know. So I wanted to dig in and figure out, is this the kind of guy that will re-energize my faith? You know, when I first got into this, I thought maybe this guy's my kind of a Catholic. He's going to have the Catholic Church doing social justice work.
Mm-hmm.
And he challenged me on that.
Yeah.
Challenges me today. You know, social justice work is important to serve the poor, but the poor can serve you just as profoundly, if not more so, than you can serve them. You can learn from them. And I think a lot of people, you know, me included, thought, well, you know, do I really listen to the poor? Do I really want to treat them as human beings, or are they there to be served by me because I'm smarter and I went to a good college and I got a degree from Harvard and I'm a big shot?
Tell them what kind of shoes this leader wanted in his priests.
Well, he wants priests to smell like the sheep, and he wanted mud on their shoes.
Dirty shoes.
Dirty shoes. And he had a great story. You know, I was talking to a couple of Jesuits who were novices when Bergoglio was running the seminary over there in Buenos Aires. And he said to them, he could tell which Jesuits had gone out into the streets and worked with the poor, because when they come back at the end of the day, he'd look at their shoes. And if you didn't have mud on your shoes, he knew you went upstairs and took a nap or you were studying. And he wanted them out smelling like the sheep, but also having mud on their shoes. And I love that image. It's about getting out of your comfort zone.
I love
zone.
It too. Dirty shoes priest.
Dirty shoes priest, right?
You know, a lot of people listening to this probably have the image of the church, not just the Catholic Church, but churches, as closed and judging. Closed and judging. But Francis is trying to make his church and faith open and encountering, which is a very different thing, open and encountering.
Yeah, it's a pastor, right? Yeah. I mean, one of the great stories I learned in the writing of this book was he tells the story when he's the head of the seminary, a woman who had little children's husband left her, had to turn to prostitution at times in order to make ends meet, and they sent food over to her, and she came over just before Christmas at this time and asked to see Jorge Mario Bergoglio, Pope Francis. And he came over and saw her, and he goes, "I'm glad you got the food." And she said, "Well, thank you for the food, but more importantly, thank you for always calling me Senora."
Yeah,
and treating somebody with dignity made me think about the way I interact with the homeless guy in front of our office here in D.C. I actually know his name? Do I call him Mister? Do I make these little gestures of human connection that he made with that woman that was almost as important as feeding her kids, maybe just as important. Yeah. He treated her like a human being. And I think that's what great teachers do. And that's what this Pope is. He's trying to say to me, Mark Shriver, do you really care about that homeless guy? And he's got this great line about, do you give him money or do you walk by? And if you give him money, do you actually put it in their hands and look them in the eyes? Or do you just drop it in the bucket, put your head down and walk away as fast as possible? Are you afraid of them? They smell, do you not want to touch them? And God, you know, when I thought about it, I don't give the money as often as I should. And I don't know that I know the guy's name now, because he's getting me out of that comfort zone. And he's asking me to try to develop an intimate relationship with somebody I don't know.
That story about what he said about what you should do with a homeless guy in the street, that sparked a whole discussion in my Georgetown class on public policy. It was the best discussion we've ever had about the dignity of every human being.
Yes, you know? I can only imagine. I mean, it happened in my head. It just challenges you to core. I mean, are you enabling them if you give them money? I mean, the Pope came out and said, don't worry about it. It's between them and God.
That's right.
Yeah. And so, he's right.
So while he's speaking to us all so personally, he's a guy with bone-deep political instincts as well. I mean, he spoke very directly, speaking the truth to power, to two presidents in Argentina, right?
Yes, he did. He did it with the Kirchners, with both the Kirchner presidents. I mean, he doesn't fit into a box. Yeah. You know, you want to make him a progressive or a conservative. You want to make him, and here in America, would he be a Democrat or a Republican? His boss, as corny as it sounds, is Jesus Christ. And his approach to the poor, it's very much grounded in his training as a Jesuit. And if power doesn't agree with him, he doesn't mind speaking up. He's free. The guy is completely free. You know, the Jesuits talk about, and Ignatius talks about, this disordered attachment, that you have a connection to things that stop your connection to God. And I think he's about as free as any human being I've seen. He doesn't have any of those disordered attachments, connections to money, power, prestige. I don't think he cares about any of that stuff. I don't think he cares about being Pope. I think he cares about, how is he going to move us all a little closer to a relationship with God? And if that means, you know, criticizing President Trump or Secretary Clinton, he's going to do it. When he comes to America and he gets in that little Fiat and President Obama gets in that huge SUV, he's sending us a message. When he has a birthday party and he invites homeless people, he's sending a message.
I've never seen an individual guest in the country impact the whole country the way he did in those 3 days. And in Washington, we both saw him speak to the Congress, almost a papal State of the Union. He said, "You are the face of its people, the representatives. You are called," he said, "to defend and preserve the dignity of your fellow citizens in the tireless and demanding pursuit of the common good. for this is the chief aim of all politics. So he called them to their calling.
Yes.
To their vocation, no matter what party they were. And they had to listen to this pope tell them what their calling was. I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, he's good. And that's what great leaders do. They set the bar higher and they challenge your core beliefs, especially when they're disordered. And you're attached to power and prestige. And that's not if you're in the public sector. You're supposed to, as he said beautifully, and you just read it, you're supposed to be out there for the common good and for everyone. He says it's, you know, interacting with God happens in the little things in life. And I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always thought you had to do big things. You had to, you know, create big programs, or you had to impact tens of thousands of people, if not more. And he talks about these little small gestures that make a difference in life. And they create these little, to paraphrase Bobby Kennedy, ripples of hope. And I think that's what he's talking about, these small little gestures, like talking to a woman who may be forced into prostitution to feed her kids, like the homeless guy. You know, he said he has always this expression about a church that's open and tending to the wounded rather than closed and suffocating itself. I mean, I'm paraphrasing it, but he wants it to be open and he wants it to be out there doing these small gestures that add up.
The power of your book is it's about your pilgrimage alongside your study of his. So when you speak about his dark night of the soul and what that meant to him, then you spoke about your dark night of the soul. Tell us about that.
Well, I think what you're referencing is, you know, I ran for Congress. I lost a couple of years later.
2,500 votes.
I don't know what the total end up was at the end, but it was close. But it ended up being the best thing that happened to me because, you know, I'd get to take care of my mom and dad as they aged. My mother died. My uncle died 2 weeks later, who I was close to. And then, you know, a year and a half later, my dad died. So there were a series of these mighty blows. And then, you know, you get into the Catholic Church and they were having the sexual abuse scandal and the money scandal. So it wasn't a dark night of the soul. I mean, I'm not Saul on the road to Damascus when I'm knocked off my donkey or—
No, but it hits you very deeply.
Yeah,
very
it does.
Hard.
Yes, yeah. It does. It definitely does. And it's a series of smaller events over time, I guess was my point, is it wasn't, you know, a one-year window or one event. It was a series of things. And then he comes out and he starts doing these gestures and I wanted to dig in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I don't know if it's changed me that much. My wife probably disagrees, but it's, you know, he's really challenged me to look at even the work I do at Save the Children Action Network, the work we do, you know, delivering services to kids through Save the Children. He says in there, in many cases, you know, watch out for the big NGOs, the big nonprofits. You want to be close to the people. Mm-hmm. And am I that close to the people that we're serving? Am I out of my comfort zone? And am I trying to make systemic change? Do I really focus in on that? And I think those are great questions to ponder and to wrestle with. So, I mean, I'm not in that dark night right now, but I'm wrestling with him because he's challenging.
You know what struck me when you wrote about that? You come from a family where the dinner table conversation is about public service, and you have a whole history of elected officials. So I don't know what it's like, but it must have been, there aren't many families where like every kid probably consider whether they should run for office in your family, right?
Yeah.
So here you go, running for office. And yes. And it didn't work the way you had hoped and expected. And what struck me was your sense that your father, Sergeant Shriver, who ran for Vice President of the United States, founded Peace Corps and VISTA and all the rest, you sensed in the end, his love for you wasn't whether you'd win a congressional seat and now be in the Senate. It was an unconditional love for you,
right?
For your existence, for who you were.
Yep. I mean, it's, you know your mom and dad love you regardless of whether you're a state senator or a U.S. congressperson or whether you've made $5 million or whether you're hugely successful. That's really powerful. I mean, it's like, you know, the prodigal son, the father is looking always for his kid on the horizon, which at that point in time, a wealthy Jewish man would never, you know, be looking like that, would never run out of his home to go see his, you know, son down the street. These are all gestures of God's love that if you feel even a modicum of that from your parents, wow, that's a pretty strong base.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I lost. You know, next day, my mother's like, I'm coming over and playing with your kids.
Yeah,
how are you doing?
Exactly.
It's like, no big deal. They lost. And, you know, I think that's because they saw every day and every interaction. Mm-hmm. Like Ignatius said, they saw God in all things. And God's in this conversation. And, you know, people that are listening are experiencing God in their own life in different ways. So if you lose a political race, big deal. Tomorrow, you know, sun comes out, you're going to do something else.
And you talk about all the way through how for Francis, he really did want to put faith first. That wasn't putting ideology over faith or letting politics define faith. And today, I think the religious right is an example of politics defining faith. Mm-hmm. And I'm often referred to by the media as religious left. I don't want to be that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have the left or politics control and define faith. Now, all the way through your book, I saw how Francis is trying to put faith first and let that define his politics and not the other way around.
Yeah, beautiful. You just summarized it perfectly. You know, you contextualize it in the 70s and into the 80s when you have President Reagan in power and you've got the dirty war going on in Argentina and you've got the beginning of liberation theology and some of the confusion, obviously, still from Vatican II. Mm-hmm. And into this stew is this young Jorge Mario Bergoglio, and he's trying to figure it out, but he always goes back to faith in God and that everything stems from that. So when you go out and you get your shoes muddy and you're out serving people, you're being served by the poor. You're doing it from your relationship with God. You're not doing it as a non-governmental organization. That's the difference, right? They're out there because they believe in God and they believe Jesus's message about serving, treating others as you would yourself.
And you're going to be changed by your proximity to the poor.
That's exactly right.
Not believing we need some new elite to come in take care of the poor.
That's correct. That's exactly right. You know, it's this theology of the people. It's that the people have insights and wisdom to share and that the poor have that as well. He's not downplaying the importance of theologians, but he's saying that there's a lot of wisdom and insight from the poor, and that's challenging.
So this isn't how we help the poor. It's about how we get transformed by being in solidarity with the poor.
Yes.
You talk about two priests, Pepe and Toto. Who were Pepe and Toto?
Well, your eyes are lighting up, you like them.
I like them, yeah.
You like them.
But I like what happened to you when you're with them and how you felt drawn to them, but also uncomfortable in the environment that they're in.
God, these guys are alive, Jim. I mean, they are the main characters in the book. It's Father Pepe and Father Toto. They're diocesan priests who had great relationships with Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio, Pope Francis. Pope Francis asked Father Pepe to go into a very dangerous via and start outreach to Catholics in that community, to the kids that were struggling to combat the drug dealers and the crime. So these are diocesan priests that are potential martyrs because they're in very, very dangerous situations every day. I was in with Father Pepe the day before someone had been shot in a drug deal, literally in the middle of the day, just around the corner from where we were. And he doesn't have a receptionist. He's answering the phone. He's setting up the wake. I mean, these guys are really, they are the epitome of what I think the Catholic Church is, that field hospital out there, the priests with mud on their shoes, the priests and nuns that are doing God's work day in and day out, that work that's grounded in the relationship with God, and then serving and learning from the poor.
You say Pepe, Toto, and Bergoglio were challenging my very concept of what it means to be a good Catholic.
Yeah, they're right in the middle of it. They're completely, as I said about Pope Francis, they're free, because if they die, they're dying doing what they want to do for God.
But they weren't like dour, pessimistic, gloomy, judging people.
No, they're joyful. That's why I love this thing, what he wrote, The Joy of the Gospel.
Yeah.
It's not the guilt of the gospel. It's not
the
shame
of the
gospel. It's the joy of the gospel. It's like, if you're free, you're doing stuff you love to do. Pepe's eyes, you know, big, soft brown eyes, but he's working his tail off because he loves it. Toto, incredible amount of energy. I thought he like had 9 cups of coffee. But these guys are joy-filled, not always happy every day. There's a difference between happiness, right, Jim, and joy.
That's right.
And these
Big
guys,
difference.
These guys have joy, and they have a relationship with God, an intimate relationship with God and with their fellow human beings that I long for, and I think we're all longing for. And I think that's what this conversation's about, right?
My wife is named Joy, Joy Carroll, and I have a little sign in my study that says, don't postpone joy. There's all kinds of meanings to that.
Yes, there is.
So you also talked about, I didn't know what the Cartoneros was till I read your chapter.
Yeah.
It's an amazing chapter. The Cartoneros who ended up with garbage bins in the Vatican.
Yes.
What in the world?
So after the Great Depression, or their Great Depression over there in the early 2000s, this guy Sergio Sanchez and thousands of other people pick up cardboard, which is cartoneros in Spanish. They pick up cardboard and they recycle it at night, and that's how they made their living. This guy had a job before he lost it in the recession, and Cardinal Bergoglio hears about him, and he reaches out to them. He baptizes their kids. He celebrates mass outdoors. He helps them organize in order to get paid a little bit more money. And somebody says to me, you got to go meet this guy, Sergio Sanchez. He's a friend of the Pope. And I'm like, the Pope's friends with a trash collector? Yep. So I went down to his recycling plant there. Got the seagulls overhead. The highway behind there. There's trash everywhere, cardboard, plastic. They got a statue of Mary up on the wall. She's made out of cardboard. And she's wearing the outfit of the trash collectors.
Out of cardboard.
Yeah, she looked beautiful. And he spent 3 hours telling me about how the Pope had invited him to Rome for his installment mass. And I said, well, the Pope invited you? He goes, yeah, he invited me and a nun and a teacher. And I said, well, where did you sit? And he goes, I'm up front. And I said, well, where are the presidents and the prime ministers? He says, they're sitting behind me. And I said, well, what happened? He goes, afterwards, I hugged him. He's taken off his vestments. I hugged him in the back. I'm like, you're with the Pope? He just became Pope, and he goes, yeah, and he told me to keep fighting for the poor and solidarity. And Sergio had his kid baptized there the other day, I think with his second or third wife. And, the Pope—
He broke the rules?
You said it, not me. But, I'd be willing to bet you that Sergio Sanchez doesn't have an annulment. I haven't been able to verify it. But so, you know, the Pope is reaching out to guys like Sergio Sanchez, the people who are picking up trash and the people who are— planting seeds in Guatemala.
And they brought their stuff with them.
They brought their stuff with them, and they put them all, when they offered it up in mass, put it in one of Sergio Sanchez's trash collecting bins.
Which he brought to the Vatican.
He brought it right in the Vatican, rolled it right down St. Peter's. Those are the people he's hanging out with,
yeah.
Jim. That's the message, is that he is saying that Sergio Sanchez's of the world can teach us, and we can learn from them. And it seems sometimes, you know, I think he's naive, and how are we ever going to do that? You know, there's so many people in the world. There's just the poor we're always going to have with us. But he's challenging us to think differently about it. And I think that's what, as I said before, I think great leaders, political, religious leaders, challenge us to do more, to see things differently than how they exist today.
But action has to be rooted in something.
Faith.
And
that's what it is for these
guys. And so that's why when I talk about this show about the two great hungers, a hunger for justice and the hunger for spirituality. If we're just talking spirituality in this nation, an affluent country, that becomes another commodity. You buy the book, the guru, go to the retreat, and it can become very narcissistic.
Yes.
You know? Unless it is tested by justice. But to just act for justice without being rooted in spirituality can lead to exhaustion and despair and anger. And even violence.
And that's what these great examples have, joy.
Yeah.
And I think they're joy-filled despite the challenges, because it's rooted in their relationship to God.
Yeah.
And that was an eye-opener for me. It's, if you're out kind of slugging it out every day, you do become, overwhelmed. And you do think, oh my God, I got to do this all by myself, or I got to do it in partnership with another nonprofit. But if you're doing it grounded in your relationship to God, then you're joy-filled. And I think, my father, I wrote this book on him called A Good Man, was excited every day. And if he loses his race for vice president, he ran for president, he got whooped in that race too, didn't care, because there's another opportunity to be joy-filled and to do something else in relationship to God.
Tell our listeners the first thing Pope Francis said to the world. What did he ask of us when he became Pope?
This is to pray for him. There's a great picture of him of about a year ago when he's at the confessional in St. Peter's. Everybody's walking by. They don't see him. And he's in his Pope outfit, all white. And he's kneeling on the kneeler, confessing to just a random priest in St. Peter's. And people are walking by him. He knows he needs to have that relationship with God every day and refresh to give him that joy and that energy in order to do his job. He's vulnerable and he's open. And that's a powerful way to live.
I want to thank you for being here, Mark. And thank you for how your book helps us understand the pilgrimage of Jorge Bergoglio. But even deeper, how it helps us understand the pilgrimage that we can make too, and that we can respond the way he has learned to respond. And this pilgrimage is an open path for every one of us.
Thank you very much. It's beautiful. Thank you.
That was Mark Shriver, author of Pilgrimage, My Search for the Real Pope Francis. Francis' message is beginning to actually change the church in important ways. And it's challenging politics and how powerful people are making decisions. But his message is not just to the church or to political leaders, but also to each of us. It's about what it means to treat everyone with dignity. Not just doing things for people, but with them. Francis wants a church not just for the poor, but with the poor, and even, he says, of the poor. What does it mean to be open to being changed by the people around us, and especially the people most often ignored? The irony of Pope Francis is that he is the head of the Catholic Church, one of the most established of all the establishments. Yet he is willing to take on all the establishments, including his own. How do we find the courage to do that too? To take on the establishments around us and that we are even a part of? Francis reminds us to always respect the needs and dignity of others, especially those easily left out and left behind. I love the glorious phrase that he often repeats too. The preferential option for the poor, putting the poor first, prioritizing the poor. That turns our world upside down. I would encourage you to read Pilgrimage, Mark Shriver's book, and any of the many other books about Francis, but don't do that to just admire him. Instead, ask how the pilgrimage of Francis can change your own pilgrimage. The first thing Francis said to the world after being named Pope was asking us to pray for him. So regardless of what our faith is or isn't, that kind of humility, confession, and commitment can change us all and the world along with us. Our program was produced by Kitty Isley and engineered by Paul Woodhull. The executive producer is Lee Hernandez. Thanks to Eric Newsom at Audible. I'm Jim Wallace. Join me again next time for Jim Wallace in Conversation.